crop up as an earworm. So they're highly idiosyncratic.
Which brings me to the issue of who amongst us is more prone to earworms. Even as I'm speaking, there's a terrible track by 1980s pop chart heartthrobs Duran Duran invading my frontal lobes. A song I've never consciously liked or listened to, Your Honour. Yet trampling across fields on the South Downs on a damp summer morning, Vaughan Williams' The Lark Ascending can't fail to surface, even though it disappears when I smile at its obviousness as a musical accompaniment.
Well, the person who has written, as far as I know, most recently and probably best research recently is Dan Levitin, and he suggests that the indications are that by and large musicians have are more subject to earworms than non-musicians. On the other hand, you can see the logic of that, because after all, musicians spend all day long putting music in their ears.
I had a band when I was in primary school, and I had a band in secondary school, and I had a band when I went to art college, ended up signing a record deal, and the band went on for years, and I produced other bands for years. Anyway, yeah, music was everything.
Clive Langer, professional pop musician and producer for Madness and Elvis Costello, has 35 years of earworms to recall, some created by his own hand. And they don't always bring pleasure.
A lot of it for me could be a record I've been working on, and a line is just stuck in my head. So I go to sleep with it in, and I wake up with it, and it's just boring. It's just because of the repetition that's gone through the day. Whereas for a person who doesn't work in music, to suddenly have something come to their mind and then to try and work out where it came from is a lot more interesting, really.
The one I've had for the last few days is the 1952 Stan Getz version of Autumn Leaves. It's very quiet, that breathy.
David Stafford is a writer, broadcaster and occasional musician.
Sometimes I wake up in the with my foot tapping and my wife says, "What is it?" I go, "It's the wrong time and the wrong place, though your face is love." And there's always a tune there, first thing in the morning. As soon as I wake up, there's something going on. The worst ones are the ones that you can't remember and you realise you've got an obscure Charlie Parker. And I defy anybody to identify that. Is it Bloom Dido or Ornithology?
In terms of individual differences in earworm phenomena, what we find to be quite important is not the level of musical training that somebody has, but rather the importance that they place on music in their life. And it's possible to be unable to play any musical instrument, but yet still be very musical if you are an avid listener to music.
A quality shared by our human jukeboxes.
I was always very much into my music, quite big into musicals, classical, every form. And also I've always sung, apparently. I used to sing from a very, very early age.
There's an internal rhythm going all the time. It's always there.
And one possibility is that these individuals have stronger couplings between certain areas of the brains, and that's why they are very likely to have this involuntary musical memory.
As Dr. Oliver Sacks observes in his excellent study, Musicophilia, we are now enveloped by a ceaseless musical bombardment in public and private places. So alongside the music we love, our environment has become an earwormery.
Well, I guess the obvious one off coming off Sunday night in the closing Olympic ceremony was Waterloo Sunset, Ray Davies and the Kinks. Dirty
old river. For the moment, it's Waterloo Road or Sunset, whatever it is. I thought it was a Paul McCartney tune at first, but apparently it's not.
Suddenly, I think probably everybody in London was walking around going, "Dirty old river."
But I don't really sing out loud. Most of the singing is in my head. Ding,
ding, ding. Does the brain get more out of externalising earworms by singing as they potter around as opposed to keeping it inside?
We know from brain imaging work that actually motor areas of the brain are involved even when you're just hearing this internally generated music. It might just be a question of, you know, personality or inhibition, how inhibited people are.
If you feel free enough and confident enough to sing, then you're unaware that you're doing it sometimes. But I won't be afraid.
I could listen to Patrick all day. But although it might seem that simply hearing a tune triggers an earworm, other factors are more powerful. memories, life events, associations, or even a glimpse of sun through the clouds can crank up the internal jukebox.
Yeah, well, I mean, you can have happy ones. I mean, you suddenly look up and you think, oh, the sun is out, the sky is blue. And then you start singing a song that relates to that. I mean, we kind of find myself walking along singing that, and that means I'm happy.
Oh, lovely day, Bill Withers. That's a perfect one for, you know, that always pops into your head as soon as the sun comes out. When I wake up in the morning...
I possibly go to prayer-like songs now and again, because I'm not religious. I think normally with me, it's kind of like, what's it all about, life? It's kind of... George Harrison seems to kind of come up quite often with lyrics that... I mean, give me hope. You know, they're almost like prayers, I suppose.
Lovely day, lovely day, lovely day, lovely day, lovely day. And of course, you can hang on to the long note, or you can do the backing bit where you just go, lovely day, lovely day. That'll drive people mad.
Is there a way in which our brains use earworms to kind of cajole us? You know, sometimes I feel like I'm mocked by the songs that pop into my head.
Like what?
You've lost that love and feeling by the Righteous Brothers. It suddenly pops in to my head if I'm feeling slightly self-pitying about my kind of relationship, for example. This is being far too revealing. But, you know, it doesn't wrap me in kind of reassuring self-pity. It actually prompts me to think, oh, for goodness sake, snap yourself out of this feeling.
Well, that could be this phenomenon of you actually want to inhibit certain types of thoughts. So, you know, I guess your brain's mental jukebox has got all these other suggestions of things that you might not really want to acknowledge.
So the earworms may betray our conscious desire to keep some thoughts or feelings hidden.
If I've been in a relationship I've not been sure about, I've sort of come out with something. And often the Bob Dylan one, "It Ain't Me, Babe," I found coming into my head, and it's such a loud and clear message, really. And there's no getting around the main line. "It ain't me, babe. It ain't me you're looking for, babe." You know, it's kind of like it's over.
A close family friend died, and she was very dear to myself and many members of our family. And we gathered together for the family funeral, and the body was about to arrive. And for some extraordinary reason, the only tune that came into my head was... Ding dong, the witch is dead.
It's a bit like Freud's famous introductory lectures where he starts with slips of the tongue, which seem like such unimportant things. And he brilliantly unwraps slips of the tongue so that the fact that we have uttered something means that there was some truth in it. And I think that's how these things work.
It's not always you sing and it has significance. I think sometimes it can be a bit like dreams again. It can be associated with a word or something you've just read. But sometimes it really is about your feelings. And when it is, you can really tell. It sends you messages, I think. Yeah.
Sometimes it's pleasurable, but a lot of the time it's kind of annoying.
Yes. What happens when good earworms turn bad?
It's terrible. These songs go round and round and round in my head. I mean, it's very hard to get rid of.
It starts affecting everything that you do. You brush your teeth in time. Jung, jung, ga-dunk, jung, ga-dunk, jung, da-da, ga-da-da, da-ga-da. The only way I've ever discovered of getting rid of one is to replace it with something. But quite often the something that you replace it with is even worse than the one you've got.
For all the light-hearted aspects of earworms, it can sometimes enter the realm of serious disturbance and distress.
In the case of musical hallucinations, people do not realise that the source of that sound is from their own brains or from their own heads. They look around for the source of the sound as if it's really coming from a record player or from a radio.
Is that more disturbing than reassuring, as a lot of earworms tend to be?
Oh, yes. People are very plagued with these musical hallucinations very often. Typically, musical hallucinations occur when people are losing their hearing. So it seems to be when there's sort of a dearth of the sound reaching your brain, it seems that the brain triggers its own sound.
Music maps, awakens, enlivens, connects us to something which is very much deeper and significantly older than the communications we typically have in language, spoken language.
The melodies haunt us. The words may taunt us. The Human Jukebox will always have its own playlist.
And I'm sure, and absolutely convinced, there's no accident why any music engages us. We can call it high art, pop, anything you like. If it stays with us, if it fulfills some really quite profound life function, it's going to be part of who we are.
Peter Curran there, celebrating the Human Jukebox. The producer was Sarah Jane Hall. Well, a very warm welcome back to the Royal Albert Hall from me, Susie Klein. We're halfway through Mozart's opera, The Marriage of Figaro, the first of his three great masterpieces, written in conjunction with librettist Lorenzo da Ponte. We left the action at the close of Act Two as Marcellina, Bartolo and Basilio hit Figaro with the claim that he must marry Marcellina as a legal promise for an unpaid debt. Earlier today, I talked to tonight's conductor, Robin Ticciati, about how Mozart creates his rich cast of characters and how at the close of Act Two, it seems like they'll never get their acts together.
Well, it's left in complete confusion. Everyone, you know, Marcellina, Basilio and Bartolo have come in and wrecked everything. And so everyone is left in a different emotional world and no one is rooted, you know, no one is rooted in any sense of security. And so the Count comes on and we have these two incredibly powerful arias, the Count's aria and the Countess's aria, that somehow take the opera into a darker and more lonely world and a real sense of confusion. It's from that that the drama unfolds and we look forward to this misfired celebration at the end of Act Three and the games of Act Four and the deception. And you still have such a long way to go, but I think what we're all leading towards this question of forgiveness and love and the Count asking for forgiveness and what that means and what it means when she says yes and whether we're meant to believe it and whether we are happy and how much we're changed. So it throws up all these questions.
How does Mozart give us a sense of characterization through music? Because we not only have a text here, we have a deep psychological world in music. Each character is really embedded in their music.
That's a big question. Why is he so great? But it's something to do with his harmonic language, his orchestration, his use of phrase structure. Everything is so immediate and yet you can't predict it. And he's constantly getting little viola counterpoint lines to sort of bubble up from the surface, and there's kind of a sexual jungle of basses going on, and then the flute comes in with... He's constantly alive with the text. And yeah, I'm working more and more at how to respond to it, how he does it, and it's a never-ending journey.
Tonight's conductor, Robin Ticciati, on the joys of conducting Mozart's Marriage of Figaro. Robin Ticciati returning to the stage of the Royal Albert Hall now for Acts 3 and 4 of this opera. The orchestra of the Age of Enlightenment, joined here at the Royal Albert Hall by the Chorus of Blinding, in a semi-stage adaptation of the Proms, a performance made by Ian Rutherford.
Che imbarazzo è mai questo? Un foglio anonimo. La cameriera in gabinetto chiusa, la padrona confusa. Un uomo che salta dal balcone in giardino. Un altro presso che dice se quel desso. Non so cosa pensar. Potrebbe forse qualcuno dei miei vassalli a simile razza comune l'ardir. Ma la contessa a che un dubbio l'offende e lo rispetta troppo a se stessa e l'onor mio. L'onore dove diamin la posto umano errore.
Via fatti fuori! Il
saprò se Cherubino era giunto a Siviglia, a tal oggetto mandato Basilio.
Cielo, il Figaro, e non ne dir nulla, invece qua volevo il marcio medesimo.
Avanti sera dovrebbe ritornar.
Dio, madonna, pensa, che il suo amore è il mio riposo.
E Susanna, chissà che l'ha tradito via il segreto mio, o sia parlato. Mi può sposare la vecchia?
Marcellina, signor!
Cosa bramate?
Mi par che si ride in collera.
Volete qualche cosa?
Signor, la vostra sposa è solitiva poi, vi chiede il fiaschetto degli odori.
Prendete!
Morvere, morto!
Ah no, potete ritenerlo per voi!
Per me, questi non son mali da donne triviali!
Un amante che perde il caro sposo sul punto d'ottenerlo!
Pagando Marcellina col dote che voi mi prometteste!
Io vi promisi quando...
L'idea di averlo inteso!
Sì! Se voluto aveste intender me voi stessa.
Il mio dovere di cui di sua eccellenza è mio potere.
Crudel, perché finora farmi languir così? Perché, crudel, farmi languir così.
Signor, la donna ignora di morir di sì.
Dunque, giardin, verrai?
Se piace a me, verrò.
E non mi mancherai.
Non mi mancherò.
Verrai. E poi di Antonio, che
scusa di dare una nipote in matrimonio. Coltivando l'orgoglio di questo mentecatto, sotto giova ora giro,
Jubilar, e jubilar. decisa la vite, o pagarla o sposarla, ora ammuttite.
Io me spero.
E di amore.
A chi sposa io sarò d'uomo che adoro.
Eccellenza, va bene, è giusta la sentenza. O pagar o sposar, bravo del corso.
Contati, sua eccellenza.
Che superba sentenza. In che superba
siamo tutti vendicati.
Io non la sposerò.
La sposerai. O pagarlo o sposarla. Lei t'ha prestati 2000 pezzi duri.
Son gentiluomo. E senza l'assenso dei miei nobili parenti dove sono? Chi sono? Lasciate ancor cercarli, dopo 10 anni io spero di trovarli.
Qualche bambino trovato?
No, perduto, dottor, anzi, rubato.
Come? La prova!
Il testimone! L'oro, le gemme e i ricamati panni che nei più teneri anni mi ritrovarono addosso i masnadieri sono gli indizi veri di mia nascita illustre. Soprattutto questo è il mio braccio impresso, geroglifico.
Una spatola impressa al braccio destro.
E a voi chi il disse?
Oddio, ed esso?
È vero, sono io.
Chi? Raffaello.
E i ladri ti rapir.
Presso un castello.
Ecco tua madre.
Paglia!
No! Tua madre.
Sua madre. Madre. Cosa sento?
Ecco tua madre. Mi conosci in questo plesso una mia madre figlio.
Padre mio, fate lo stesso. Suo padre.
Parliamo di fatti cerimoni. Egli è mio figlio. Mia consorte voi siete. E le noci faremo quando volete. Ancora?
Bravi, gittate pur che io piglio gli ora.
Vogliamo di informar d'ogni avventura, madame il nostro zio, al par di me contento, che al par di me contento.
Io.
Schiante, signor Conte,
al gusto mio.
Io vi dico, signor, che Cherubino è ancora nel castello. Deve vedere per prove il suo cappello.
Ma come se a quest'ora esse giunto a Siviglia e dovria?
Scusate, oggi Siviglia è a casa mia. La vestissi da donna e la lasciate all'altri amici suoi.
Perfidi!
Andiamo e li vedrete voi.
Musmira ricche che mi disse fonte, gli si digiva il fronte, l'ispetto e la rabbia. Io, e mio oro vorremmo in capia. Dov'è l'appuntamento che tu gli proponesti? In giardino, vestia mio nuovo. Scrivi, chi lo scriva? Ma signora, scrivi, che tutto io prendo su me stessa. Canzonetta,
proponire la tua disobbedienza.
Eccellenza, eccellenza, voi mi dite sì spesso qual volta m'abbracciate e mi baciate. Barbari, se mai, ti darò quelli bravi.
Io dissi questo.
Voi, or datemi padrone in sposo un cherubino e v'amerò con voi, mio gattino, che bel porto con voi.
Brava figliola, hai buon maestro che ti fa la scuola. Non so qual uomo, qual demone, qual dio, gli volga tutto quanto d'odor corto mio. Signor, se trattenete tutte queste ragazze, addio feste, addio danza.
E che vorresti ballar col piede stravolto?
Non mi dol più molto, addio belle fanciulle.
Come se cavarò dalle parozzo, lasciate fare a lui.
Per buona sorte i vasi erano di creta.
Senza fallo. Vediamo dunque, andiamo.
E intanto a cavallo di galoppo a Siviglia andava in paggio.
Di galoppo, o di massa, qual viaggio. Per i capelli giovani.
E a te la sua patente era in tasca rimasta.
Certamente, che razza di domande. Via, non li far giumotti e non ti intende. Ed ecco chi pretende che sia un bugiardo, il mio signor nipote.
Cherubino!
Or ci sei! Che diavolo incanta!
Non canta, no! Ma dice che gli saltò stamani sui garofani!
E lo dice? Sarà. Se ho saltato io, si può dare che anch'esso abbia fatto lo stesso!
Anch'esso!
Perché no? Io non impugno mai quel che non so! Ecco la marcia! Andiamo!
Ai vostri posti! Belle vostri posti!
Susanna, dammi il braccio!
Ecco!
Temerari!
Ghiaccio!
Contessa!
Guarda, parliamo! E con quelle due nozze ricevere dobbiamo! Ai pensi farò qua! Una parola si chiamo!
Si chiamo!
Thank you. ucciso la cerca. Oh, che stordito! Andate, amici, che sia per questa sera disposto l'apparato nuziale con la più ricca pompa. Che sia magnifica la festa, e canti, e fuoco, e la cena, e gran ballo. Se ognuno impari come ha tratto color che a me son cari.
Amante costante si fa cielo,
scherzo. Osserva, questa è la spilla che il conte da recare ti diede alla Susanna. E servia di sigillo un bigliettino. Vedi se io sono istrutto.
E perché il chiedi a me quando sai tutto?
Avrei gusto di dir come il padrone ti dia la commissione.
Che miracoli! Ciri fanciullo, reca questa spilla alla bella Susanna e dille, questo è il sigillo dei pini.
Ah, dei pini!
È vero che mi soggiunse, guarda che tu non vera, ma tu già tacerai. Ma
sicuramente!
A te già niente credo!
Oh, niente, niente!
Addio, mio bel cugino, voda Susanna, e poi la che
la spilla, oh madre, è quelli stessa che poc'anzi hai raccolse.
Ma questo è più di oggi un dritto di stare in guardia e vivere in sospetto. Ma non sai se in effetto...
Allerta dunque, il luogo del congresso sordo è stabilito.
Dove vai, figlio mio?
A vendicare tutti i mariti. Addio!
Avvertiam Susanna, io la credo innocente. La faccia, quell'aria di modestia, e caso al cuore che lo fosse. Ma quando il cuore non giurma personale interesse, ogni donna è portata alla difesa del suo povero sesso. Ma questi uomini ingrati la porto presso.
Contorni non vi scostate, intanto io vado a dar certi ordini e torno in pochi istanti. Un fischio mio correte tutti quanti.
Ai diavoli nel corpo!
Ma cosa nacque?
Nulla, Susanna piace il conte, ella d'accordo gli diede un appuntamento che a Figaro non piace.
E dunque dovrei soffrirlo in pace?
Quel che soffrono tanti e soffrire non potrebbe. E voi sentite che guadagno può far? Nel mondo amico, la cozzala la con grandi fu pericolo di ora. Dal 90% han vinto ancora.
Tutto è disposto. L'ora dovrebbe essere vicina. Io sento gente. E te sa? Non è alcun. Ed io incomincio mai a fare il scimunito mestiero di marito. Ingrata del momento della mia cerimonia, mi godeva leggendo, e nel vederlo io rideva di me senza saperlo. Susanna, Susanna, quanta pena mi costi con quell'ingenua faccia, con quegli occhi innocenti, chi creduto l'avria. Che il filar sia donna, a donna, ignor follia. Aprite un poco gli occhi, uomini incolti e sciocchi. Guardate queste femmine, guardate cosa sono. Guardate cosa son, guardate, guardate cosa son. Queste chiamate te, agli ingannati sensi, a cui tributa incensi, la di voler ragion, la
Fine momento, chi gudrò senza affanno, in broccioli. Passo, mi chiamo, ma voi posso male, mi arrivo ben presso il mio servore.
Yeah. Order is restored. Figaro has his Susanna. The Count is repentant. The Countess accepts his plea for forgiveness. The close of Mozart's Marriage of Figaro, a live performance here at the Proms, given by conductor Robin Ticciati, the Orchestra of the Age of Enlightenment, led by Alison Berry, the Glyndebourne Chorus, their chorus master, Jeremy Vines. Applause for Katie Bray and Ellie Lahm, the bridesmaids, Nicholas Folwell as Antonio, the gardener, Sarah Schaefer, Barbarina, Colin Johnson, Don Curzio. Alan Oak, the tenor, stepping forward, sang Don Basilio, the oleaginous music master, so brilliantly. Andrew Shaw, who sang Dr. Bartolo. Closely followed by two of the great stars of this evening's performance for me. Such a firm favourite at ENO, the Royal Opera House, Anne Murray, who sang Marcellina, and followed by Isabel Leonard, making her Proms debut as the lusty page Cherubino. Hand in hand now, the Count and the Countess, reconciled at last as he kisses her hand, Sally Matthews as the Countess Almaviva. And stepping forward in his crushed dark red velvet suit there, Odin Epperson as Count Almaviva, the aristo with a wandering eye. And finally, Figaro and his Susanna take to the stage here at the Royal Albert Hall. Susanna sung tonight by the soprano Lydia Teuscher. Absolutely brilliant, I thought, in the title role, Figaro, the bass Vito Priante. And all those bows and all that applause closes this semi-stage performance. It was made specially for the Proms by Ian Rutherford, adapted from the sell-out Glyndebourne production of this opera, directed by Michael Brandage. And that closes proceedings for tonight here at the Royal Albert Hall. Don't forget that, as always, you can hear everything that we've heard tonight again. Just go to the BBC iPlayer for that. Robin Ticciati taken to the stage now, and the players of tonight's orchestra, the OAE, the Orchestra of the Age of Enlightenment, soaking up the atmosphere in a packed Royal Albert Hall. Well, every one of the Proms, as I'm sure you know, is broadcast live here on Radio 3. We will be back here tomorrow, but for now, it's time to hand you back to Broadcasting House and over to Jonathan Swain.
Susie, thank you very much. Susie Klein there at the Royal Albert Hall. And we're back at the hall for our next Prom tomorrow evening at 7 o'clock. Martin Brabbins conducting performances of Hymnos Paradisi by Herbert Howells and Elgar's First Symphony. And in fact, that's the first of two Proms tomorrow night. Our late night Prom brings Eric Whittaker to the Albert Hall as conductor of his own beautifully crafted choral music. There'll also be pieces by Leonard Bernstein and others. And add the sound of the 48 voice combined choirs with the Albert Hall acoustics, and it should be something of a choral feast of a concert. That's our late night Prom tomorrow night, live here on Radio 3 at 10:15. Well, back to tonight, and in 25 minutes' time, roughly, this evening's feature, The Miracle of Cartagena. Poet and novelist Owen Shears visits a Colombian city reborn through its own great literary heritage. That's our feature at 10:15. And then Max Reinhardt will be here with this evening's Late Junction. Among Max's musical offerings tonight, Katia and Maria Labeck, Idle Chatter by Paul Lansky, The Noise Between Thoughts, performed by the Kronos Quartet, and a tribute to Bill Evans by Chick Corea. Late Junction is at 11 o'clock tonight. For the moment, French music. This is Darius Milhaud's Sonata for Flute, Oboe, Clarinet and Piano, music from 1918 when Milhaud was in his mid-20s and based in Rio. Four movements here, somewhere in the impish second of them, Debussy's Ghost is listening, and the somber finale is a reaction to a very serious flu outbreak in Rio, a time when carts filled with coffinless bodies were seen everywhere. The players are Catherine Quentin, flute, Maurice Bourg, oboe, Michel Portal, clarinet, and the pianist is Pascal Roger.
Thank you.
Darius Milhaud's Sonata for Flute, Oboe, Clarinet and Piano. The players there, Catherine Quentin, flute, Maurice Bourg, oboe, Michel Portal, clarinet, and the pianist was Pascal Roger. Well, to follow that, I wonder, do you perhaps remember Georgia Brown, singer, actress and general phenomenon? Her ascent to stardom came with her Nancy in Lionel Bart's Oliver in London and then on Broadway. That was in the early 1960s. Well, here she is around that time in The Saga of Jenny from Kurt Weill's 1941 Broadway musical Lady in the Dark. The lyrics by Ira Gershwin.
There once was a girl named Jenny, whose virtues were varied and many, excepting that she was inclined always to make up her mind. And Jenny points a moral with which you cannot quarrel, as you will find. Jenny made her mind up when she was three, as she herself was gonna trim the Christmas tree. Christmas Eve she lit the candle, tossed the tapers away, and little Jenny was an orphan on Christmas Day. Poor Jenny, bright as a penny, her equal would be hard to find. She lost one dad and mother, a sister and a brother, but she would make up her mind. But Jenny made her mind up when she was 12 that into foreign languages she would delve. But at 17 to Vassa it was quite a blow, that in 27 languages she couldn't say no. Poor Jenny, bright as a penny, her equal would be hard to find. To Jenny I'm beholden, her heart was big and golden, she would make up her mind. Jenny made her mind up at 22, to get herself a husband was the thing to do. She got herself all dolled up in her satins and furs, and she got herself a fella and he wasn't hers. Poor Jenny, bright as a penny, her equal would be hard to find. Deserved a bed of roses, but history discloses that she would make up her mind. Jenny made her mind up at 75. She would live to be the oldest woman alive. But gin and rum and destiny play funny tricks. Jenny kicked the bucket at 76. Jenny points a moral with which you cannot quarrel, makes a lot of common sense. A Jenny in the saga, prove that you a gaga if you just keep sitting on the fence. All men and womankind. Anyone with vision comes to this decision. Don't make up, you shouldn't make up, or never make up, you mustn't make up. Anyone with vision comes to this decision. Don't make up your mind. She could swing, but she sometimes goofed.
Georgia Brown, recorded 50 years ago this year with an orchestra, I beg your pardon, conducted by Ian Fraser in The Saga of Jenny by Kurt Weill.
On Radio 3 from the BBC Proms, Sir Simon Rattle and the Berlin Philharmonic. Two consecutive evenings from this most celebrated of musical partnerships, starting with a programme that includes the suite from Ravel's Daphnis and Chloe and Debussy's Je, and in the following night's concert, the exhilarating second piano concerto by Brahms. The Berlin Philharmonic at the BBC Proms, starting Thursday night at 7:30 on BBC Radio 3.
This is BBC Radio 3. It's 10:15. Time now for our feature, another chance to hear the poet and novelist Owen Shear's take on the literary city of Cartagena, Colombia, a programme first broadcast in May 2011. Cartagena, on Colombia's Caribbean coast, helped inspire the work of one of Latin America's greatest writers, Gabriel Garcia Marquez. Yet less than a decade ago, the city was at the sharp edge of Colombia's devastating civil conflict, receiving thousands of refugees from the cocaine wars that ravaged the country. Well, back in 2006, Owen Shears took part in the inaugural Hay Festival, Cartagena, the first Latin American outpost of the famous British Literary Festival. Since then, security has improved and Colombia is slowly welcoming back foreign visitors. As its citizens prepared to host last year's festival, Owen returned to the city to find out how Cartagena is using the allure of its cultural heritage to bring in much-needed tourist income, and to discover if a literary legacy can be harnessed to bring about real change for the city's poor and displaced.
I first came to Cartagena 6 years ago now, and I must say that that first visit was a surprisingly seminal experience for me. I think I was slightly ambushed by the place. It's such a seductive city, but it also has a very dark edge, and it was an extraordinary place to found a literary festival. So I suppose I'm fascinated to find out how the city has changed since then and what it's done with its past literary heritage, with its relationship with Marquez, and I suppose with its current literary culture. It's a very striking drive because on my right hand side there is just ocean for as far as I can see, whereas there on my left are Las Morales, the walls. God, I don't know how high they are. They look about sort of maybe 60 feet high, and I think they're around 30 or 40 feet wide. And they were built to defend the city from us, from the raiding, looting privateers like Mr. Francis Drake, who we think of as a hero, but here he was a guy who used to come along and steal things. Oh, and that is actually Marquez's house. That is Gabriela Garcia Marquez's house, an ochre-coloured building on a corner of a street there. The walls are very high, but when he's here, that is where Marquez lives. Along the rough cobbled streets that had served so well in surprise attacks and buccaneer landings, weeds hung from the balconies and opened cracks in the whitewashed walls of even the best-kept mansions. And the only signs of life at 2 o'clock in the afternoon were languid piano exercises played in the dim light of siesta. Indoors, in the cool bedrooms saturated with incense, women protected themselves from the sun as if it were a shameful infection. And even at early mass, they hid their faces in their mantillas. Their love affairs were slow and difficult and were often disturbed by sinister omens, and life seemed interminable. Although Marquez never names the city of viceroys that infuses every page of Love in the Time of Cholera, there can be no doubt that this novel's fictional city is intimately drawn from and mapped onto the real city of Cartagena. When Marquez first arrived in the city, a penniless young journalist fleeing the civil war raging in his native Bogota, a relationship between a city and a writer was precipitated that is perhaps unparalleled in 20th century literature. Charles Dickens had his London, Balzac and Proust their Paris, and now Gabriel Garcia Marquez had his Cartagena. the city would become his creative and psychological wellspring, a treasure trove of stories, characters, and flavour. As you walk along its narrow cobbled streets, hemmed in by the huge medieval walls and overhung by balconies, it really is as if an entire literary genre, what we've come to call magical realism, has been made manifest around you. Here's Marquez again, allowing his imagination to echo around the fabric of the city. He walked with her through the old city, where their footsteps echoed like horses' hooves on the cobblestones. From time to time, fragments of fugitive voices escaped through open balconies, bedroom confidences, sobs of love magnified by phantasmal acoustics and the hot fragrance of jasmine in the narrow, sleeping streets.
This country have their Shakespeare now. Every kid in this country knows the stories of Gabriel Garcia Marquez. It's their cultural heritage. You know, you think of the horrendous wars that they were going through. Actually, what matters to people here is their own culture. And there's something magical about this town because it is, to Latin Americans, what Venice is to us. It's the beautiful city of dreams, the city you aspire to, that romantically you will take yourself one day and discover things about, you know, life and art.
That was Peter Florence, the founder and director of the Hay Literary Festival. Back in 2006, Peter invited me to speak at the festival's first ever Latin American outpost. They couldn't have picked a more seductive spot. While Venice has its gondolas, in Cartagena, you're never far away from the evocative sound of the famous carretas, wheeled carts clattering noisily through the city's humid, narrow alleys selling exotic fruits, water, ices and other delights. Now, every January, squeezed between the Miss Columbia beauty pageant and a festival of international cinema, the clatter of these wheeled carts vies with the trundle of suitcases across the hot cobblestones, as the city prepares once again to welcome a legion of literary tourists.
We have 35 stations on the walking tour. This is the map. So you start here, and the beautiful thing is that you can see the city through Garcia Marquez's eyes.
Yes, yeah.
But you can learn about the history of the city too.
Mm. You can basically use the novels like a guidebook in a way.
Of course.
You really can.
Of course.
For the literary academics, Iliano Restrepo Hernandez and Ignacio Vélez, identifying the realism behind Marquez's magical prose has been a life's work. Mapping the work of the author, known locally as Gabo, onto the real locations in the living, breathing city of Cartagena. They've woven their research into a unique audio tour through which you can immerse yourself in the real sounds, smells and streets through which Florentino pursued Femina in Love in the Time of Cholera. But for those drawn to the city by the wild flights of Marquez's imagination, by his skills as a writer of fiction, discovering his factual sources lying so close to the surface can be a disillusioning experience. "You're just a notary without imagination," was the accusation levelled at Marquez by one Spanish visitor. It's that playful, often surreal blurring of prosaic reality and exaggerated fantasy that has made magic realism a global literary phenomenon. But as we toured one of the key locations that inspired Love in the Time of Cholera, the park where the teenage Florentino waited patiently for his beloved, I couldn't help but wonder if the seductive, unique qualities of Cartagena actually rendered Gabo's magic realism, well, a little less magical. Or a little too real, depending on your perspective.
Yes, we're getting into Parque Fernández de Madrid. We think that this was the little gospel park. In Spanish, it says El Parquecito de los Evangelios. And in these benches were the ones where Florentino Ariza sat down to simulate that he reads. For her to go out and cross the park to go to the school that was through that corner. And that house over there, the white house, it's the biggest house in the square. So when we read the book, we said, okay, in the gospel part, the biggest house in the square with 2-3 stories.
And with the balconies on
those
heights.
With the balconies and that. So that must be the house of Fermina. And we cross stories with Jaime, his brother, with Jaime Garcia Marti. He said, yes, we went here one time with Gabo, and he said, that's going to be the house of Fermina. And he uses all the time reality mixed with his imagination.
Sure.
Every time.
Sure. In my head, when I read the book, it was a much larger part.
Of course.
And it's incredible how powerful those images, you know, even though I read the book quite some time ago now, I can really see the part as I had it.
And
I suppose it's interesting, isn't it, Ian? Because this tour is fascinating. It is absolutely amazing. But at the same time, if I read the book again, I'll see this part. I suppose it subtly breaks down those images that we actually create ourselves.
Sometimes they match. Sometimes they don't.
No, they don't. No.
He sat on the most hidden bench in the little park, pretending to read a book of verse in the shade of the almond trees until he saw the impossible maiden walk by in her blue striped uniform. Sometimes they match, sometimes they don't. What does it mean as a reader to come across places already so intimately created in your own imagination and then to have them replaced by a very different reality? What was becoming clear to me was that it's Marquez's relationship with the real and true in Cartagena that's now driving the city's literary tourism. Picking off what and where he'd used as sources, celebrating those places where that disjuncture between fantasy and reality is most faint.
So where have you come here from?
From Sacramento, California.
California.
Uh-huh. Okay.
Yeah, and started off in Fort Lauderdale, is where this ship took off from.
And when you heard that the ship was going to be coming into Cartagena, what were your initial thoughts? Was that one of the reasons why you took the cruise?
Yeah, that was
it. Was
we
actually because some
see.
Other itineraries did not include Cartagena, and we'd just never been here, and just was very
just
curious.
To see the historical part, not the new.
Sure.
Yeah.
Just the old city.
You can get a good overview of it from the ship.
Right.
That.
Because
yeah.
I'm not sure if you're aware, but as recently as 6 years ago, I think Cartagena was actually blacklisted from all of the cruise liners.
Yeah.
And they didn't call in here.
Because of all the drugs. And,
yeah.
They say
yeah.
Cartagena was built on cocaine.
Carlos was shot in the throat outside the Parque del Poblado. It was night and he was selling basuco to the crackheads when the rich kids came in their yellow jeep and cleansed him. Salesio joined his elder brother in the local militia, where he sent back a photo of himself in a balaclava, holding an Uzi sub and a Beretta 45. You could see the shape of his stupid smile through the black cotton. This is from the short story Cartagena by the Australian-Vietnamese writer Nam Le. It presents a very different kind of Colombian reality. When I first visited this city 6 years ago, the country was still embroiled in civil war. Deadly armed conflict between cocaine gangs, rival paramilitaries and armed guerrilla groups such as the infamous FARC had resulted in massive internal migration, with thousands dreaming, like the young mobsters of Nam Le's story, of fleeing to Cartagena's colonial shores. What they found when they got there, however, were often heaving slums, a world away from the rarefied old city, mile upon mile of barrios that still teem today with the poor and displaced. It's an issue you can't escape as a visitor to the city. Gabriela Boucher, director of the charity Plan International, sees a link between the primal violence of Colombia's social devastation and the raw urgency of a new creative response to that present-day reality.
I think Colombia has so many contrasts. It's the country of the very rich, the very poor, the very highly creative in all the arts, and also the most extreme violence going on for so many years. And I think it's all very linked because it's an intense way of looking at life and maybe taking a stance. Creativity is pushed to its maximum degree. And I think at the moment what is happening is that we are tipping the balance of the destruction towards the intensity of creativity and creation of wonderful things.
It's an arresting and potent idea that from the devastation of social conflict could arise an outpouring of intense creativity. Most intriguingly, could that artistic response, expressed directly to the people through the written word, foment real social change? Colombia's new generation of writers have strived to throw off the shackles of the magical and embrace their own social and political reality. To explain, here's literary editor Marianne Ponsford. followed by the young Colombian novelist Jorge Franco.
García Márquez is alive, barely. And there's a generation of writers that are absolutely not at all overshadowed by García Márquez. In fact, they are not even trying to kill their father, because he is not their father, he is their grandfather. Take, for example, two Colombian novels that were in the short list of the Independent Foreign Fiction Prize. Evelio Rosero won with The Armies. It is a novel about our war and about the insanity of war. Take Hector Abad, who was just translated last year into English with his memoir, Oblivion. It is also about the killing of his father by the paramilitary. So our political and social reality is influenced and is informing in a very powerful way.
It's very difficult not to write about the violence. Sometimes you feel that it's you must write about these topics, about these situations, because they hurt. But I think it's also a way of healing our wounds, like I'm making a catharsis of our own problems.
It's no wonder that Jorge Franco and others have sought catharsis, a healing of wounds, through their writing. Throughout the early part of the last decade, Colombia was one of the most dangerous countries on earth, with around 50 murders per 100,000 people, more than 10 times that of the USA. One of my most powerful memories of being at that first festival was the sheer number of men with guns on the streets. More than one prominent British author declined their invitation for fear of being kidnapped. It was into this violent nexus of creativity that the festival came. Here was literature, in a far wider sense, hoping to use the allure of Cartagena's own literary heritage to reconnect the city to the global conversation. As founder of the festival, Peter Florence explains.
It became apparent that what we do in Hay is kind of applicable everywhere. The same thing happens in Nairobi. The same thing happens in Kerala. You can use what you've got, which is some of the world's greatest minds and storytellers, to talk to many, many people. You know, writers are special. They can be heard in ways other people can't.
So, ladies and gentlemen, can I introduce Germaine Greer? Thank you.
Good morning, everybody. Thank you for coming. I'm sorry that I'm not going to speak to you in Spanish.
I know that you've been to the Hay Festival in Britain many, many times.
And I went to Segovia.
Okay, and you've been to Segovia. I'm just wondering, what are your thoughts on the model of the International Literary Festival, which does seem to have been embraced especially passionately here in Cartagena?
I mean, one of the things we're trying to do here is not allow a cleavage to develop. Márquez is an international writer. Everybody is going to read him. He's also a Nobel Prize winner, which for me is always rather funny, because I think they almost always give it to the wrong person. I think the real problem with Cartagena is going to be that it is in danger of becoming a picture postcard town that is making a living out of a rather rarefied kind of tourism. And looking at the environs of the town, looking at the approach when you fly in, looking at the evidence about the mangroves, about the atmospheric pollution, about the lack of infrastructure, there's a danger that it won't feed back into the polity. And Colombia has tremendous problems to overcome, without mentioning, you know, what the drugs wars have cost Colombia. It's the peace is going to cost them even more. And it would be mad to think of a literary festival in which, you know, you had people coming from the pueblos, you know, you had people arriving in ox carts. That's not what they're like. They're amusements for a particular kind of middle-class person. Mm. I've always rather hated them, to tell you the truth.
In which case, I couldn't help thinking, after we parted company, why come and speak at them at all, Germaine? Her point about the limitations of such festivals, though, did ring true, until I spoke to the festival director, Cristina Fuentes, who had another take on the social reach of festivals like Cartagena.
Some people call us elitists because, you know, when you open all these magazines, all the photographs are about writers with all these socialites of Colombia. But to be honest, the majority of the audience is students, people from Cartagena, people that has taken maybe a bus and they have been 20 hours to come here.
It seems to me that there is the potential here, perhaps more than in other parts of the world, to sort of use literature and reading as a way to regenerate other parts of the city.
Yeah, I do agree. Yeah. I agree. 2 years ago, we took a lot of Spanish-speaking writers to the barrios to speak in public libraries, and many of them even were completely shocked by the poverty they saw.
Really?
Yes. A writer, a young writer, came saying, you know, I went to a public library, there were 4 books only there. I've never seen something like that. And he went to a bookshop, he bought 30 books, and he donated it to them. In the barrios, we have got now programs and projects going all year round, you know, capacitating teachers to teach reading and writing in the class. And we work with Fundación Plan, preparing the kids for the writer's visit. So, you know, we have done a little bit to change or to bring literature as an aspiration in to many kids. Mm.
But just as there are deep contrasts within Cartagena, between the extreme poverty of the barrios and the wealth of the old town, so there are elements of the festival that contrast strikingly with those ideals of the outreach programs Cristina had mentioned. On one night of the festival, it hosted Cuba's legendary Buena Vista Social Club in the Plaza de la Aduana, one of the city's grandest public squares, bordered by banks, bars, and the ever-present Las Morales. For the concert, however, the square was far from public. Locals pressed up against guards and security fencing to catch a glimpse of the band, while Cartagena's great and good clapped along from front row seats or sipped champagne disinterestedly from the balconies of private functions. In the wake of this scene, I couldn't help wondering if the growing popularity of the festival had meant it had become no more than a conduit for high society to party in the flattering light of literature. Cartagena was partly founded on gold that was looted by the Spanish from the indigenous people. In turn, privateers like Drake looted its treasures, and Marquez, in his own way, has raided its history and stories. So has the festival now joined this distinguished line of thieves, looting the city's literary heritage as an excuse for a party? For a view from someone with no connection with the tourist industry or the festival, I sought out Marianne Ponsford, editor of independent Colombian arts magazine Arcadia, for a bit of a reality check.
The idea of books is still something that is high up, that has still a sacred aura.
Mm. And to be honest, it feels to me as if that style, that world of magic realism, occupies a part of people's minds here which allows them to have a childlike sense of the story and the poem and how this enriches us as human beings. Mm-hmm.
Perhaps you see that here because you come here as a foreigner and you have already a romantic look. For me, as a Colombian, it is very difficult to see that. What I see is simply realism. Yes, okay, there is a library 20 kilometers from here in a tiny town. There are 4 books in that library.
Have there been novels that you feel have really affected change or that have driven change in this country?
No. No, because it is impossible to change a society through books when that society does not read. Don't forget this is a 45 million people country, and normally a book would perhaps sell 800 copies. But I think sometimes we demand too much of literature. There's too much expectation on it. I think it is a little unfair. I think a society does change when it reads in general, and when it has access to culture. And that does not happen here in Colombia, or it has not happened yet. Education is terrible. The standards are appalling. So there's so much to do here before a book can change a society, or the idea of reading can change a society.
It's funny, it's the kind of city where evening, yes, it feels like the end of the day, but it also feels like it's, you know, it's the start of so much else. There's the undeniable, slightly effervescent quality to the city that you think, okay, the business of the day is over, everyone's just taking a breath with this cool sea breeze and the sun going down. But any minute now, stories are going to start again. Or maybe that's just my hope, I don't know. We'll be right back.
So it's Tuesday night on the walls of Cartagena, and as you can hear, it's a whole other side to the city again. And you know, this is extraordinarily different to the Cartagena that I feel that I met 5 years ago. I don't know. I mean, maybe I was hanging out in the wrong places then, but I'm pretty sure that, I mean, this just wasn't here. Hey, you know, I guess this is progress. But it's weird, it's weird. We're like, we're 2 or 3 miles from Los Barrios. And 1 million miles away. And it's strange.
I couldn't help thinking about Marianne's point about the limitations of literature in a country where so few have access to books. I wanted to find out if what was happening in Cartagena was a raid on the cultural jewel that the city remains, or whether literature's power could be effectively harnessed to reach out across a newly globalised world. To do that, I had to get out of Cartagena's magical inner city to the reality of the people beyond.
It's about 3:30 on a typically hot Cartagena afternoon, and I've come up to the Technology University in Manga, where I was hoping to speak to some students about Cartagena, about the changing city, about their love of the city's literature. I mean, I was excited about that. I don't think the students were as excited because they haven't turned up. but I'm assured that this is, you know, is an example of El Tiempo Colombiano. You know, this is a Colombian time, and it's what I should expect. So I'm going to embrace the experience because there's not much else I can do, really.
One student's calling me. Hello? Stephanie, ¿dónde estás?
What did she say?
That they are
almost
like
here.
10 blocks away. She told me that before. I'm going to kill them.
The teenagers at the Universidad Simón Bolívar in the suburb of Manga are primarily students of social science and humanities, not of arts or literature, or it would seem timekeeping. Yet the university prides itself on its belief that the study of literature is crucial to the development of its future engineers, politicians and social scientists, and runs compulsory classes for all its students. While waiting for our interviewees to turn up, I started chatting to Administrator Ana Molina about the thinking behind the university's ethos.
Your students here who are studying the sciences or social science, what do you think that they benefit from also studying literature as well?
Well, you know, you can't be an engineer that's going to do a road or a bridge that doesn't know the culture of the people that he's going to affect, that doesn't know the environment of the place that he's going to be.
And you feel that he will learn about the culture and he will learn about the environment, not from factual books, but from novels, from novels and poetry and from literature.
Well, I believe that the core of cultures are in their literature. You know? And if you don't know your culture, you are like a chicken without a head. My husband is Cuban, and I told him once, if you want to know the Caribbean region, read 100 Years of Solitude. Mm-hmm. that day you are going to learn and to understand a lot of things that we do.
And have you been reading lots of Cuban literature?
No. That's true.
Yeah.
No.
But when conversation turned to the festival and its effect on local regeneration, Anna's view was another stark reminder of its somewhat limited reach.
Do you feel that the Hay Festival has had a strong influence here in this part of town?
Well, I think that the Hay Festival is a festival for intellectuals. Mm-hmm. 80% of the city is really poor, and they only are thinking how are going to get to the next day. Mm. And how are going to get their food for the next day. They're not thinking in reading García Márquez. And I think the festival is for foreigners, for people from Bogota, from Barranquilla, but here in Cartagena, we really don't know what we're having every year.
Really?
I realized that the festival